Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it's a tough Monday for Miami Heat fans, for the people of Cameroon, Bosnia-Herzegovina, for Brits, Hondurans, the Japanese, Ecuadorians, Greeks, Spaniards, and Australians. Miami merely lost the NBA Finals, but those other countries got beaten in their World Cup matches. The U.S. is on pins and needles today, facing Ghana. We'll ask someone to choose between his team flag and his U.S. passport to illustrate just how the World Cup tournament messes with people's national identities. On a lighter note, we will also take a romp through the wild and wonderful career of the folk singer son of the legendary journalist and see the world through the eyes of the incredible Loudon Wainwright III. But we begin with the far grimmer Monday this represents for the people of Iraq. New gains on the ground for Sunni militants, government and Shiite forces allied on the ground north of Baghdad trying to prevent the militants from pushing further south. The town of Tal Afar has fallen into the hands of the forces of ISIS, or ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or Iraq and the Levant, which refers to the more ancient territory of Syria and eastern Lebanon. We begin with veteran journalist Christiane Amanpour, chief international correspondent for CNN. Christiane, welcome to the program.
Hello, John.
So how do you see this juggernaut of Sunni militants and ISIS, or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, heading towards Baghdad at this point?
Well, that is really the big question. Will they be able to do the same kind of thing in Baghdad that they've done in Mosul and the other areas that you've just mentioned? I think what is absolutely clear from all the interviews I've done over this and all the reporting over the last several weeks, frankly, is that this is very possibly the end of Iraq as we know it. Even if ISIS does not capture Baghdad, and remember, Baghdad is a massive city, anywhere between 7 to 9 million inhabitants and mostly Shiite, and it would obviously be very heavily defended, unlike the others that ISIS has rolled over. But what seems to be happening is that there will be a de facto partition. The Kurds in the north, ISIS-controlled territory to the west of that, including Al-Anbar, the famous Sunni heartland, and then a Shiite big state down from Baghdad to the south, encompassing all the majority Shiite areas and the Shiite shrine cities. This is perhaps what most people think is going to happen, because they believe that it's going to be incredibly difficult to push ISIS back from what it has already captured.
And you push them back into Syria, which they already control. If you look at the strategic situation on the ground in Syria, you've got tremendous instability around a fragilely defended Damascus. ISIS seems to be pretty good at getting that situation in Syria. Are they duplicating it in Iraq?
Well, let's just get the lay of the land straight here. What has happened, if you remember very well, is that when ISIS's precursor, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, had really wrecked Iraq, particularly the West, and the place was in a massive civil war, President Bush and General Petraeus ordered a surge, and that defeated these people. But it also was political. They had the Sunni tribes on track. When President Obama pulled the U.S. troops out, this started to go to hell again in a handbasket. We've been reporting for years since the end of the U.S. troops on violence and IEDs and suicide bombings all over Iraq for several years now. But add to that the chaos in Syria, and that is what has really enabled ISIS to move back and forth against porous borders and to create and plan what it said it would do, which is to try to create a caliphate in that area of the Levant, of Syria, Iraq, and they would love to do it in Lebanon as well. Syria has been left to fester, and therefore these Islamic jihadi groups have been allowed to do their planning, do their training, equipping, and moving in and out and across borders. So there's two very, very big priorities right now. It is a state of desperate urgency to try to hold the ISIS advance. If the United States, not boots on the ground, but if the U.S. can bolster Iraqi forces, if Iran and the U.S. manage to have some kind of tactical alliance in order to do that, is one thing. The other thing of equal importance and urgency is to recreate a government of national unity in Iraq. Maliki cannot do it on his own. He is sectarian, authoritarian, and he's viewed as really sort of like a Shiite dictator right now.
It seems to me, though, that why didn't portray us, and the outcome of the surge leave in place some assurance that there would be a political alliance with the Sunni power base in Anbar province after the U.S. forces left. It seems as though that wasn't even considered, and Nouri al-Maliki just basically said, "Okay, the U.S. is gone. You guys are done."
Well, you'll hear a lot of argument and playing the blame game over that. There are those who believe that the reason a residual U.S. force wasn't left in Iraq is because Nouri al-Maliki's government said no and Iran said no and the U.S. didn't try very hard. Whatever happened, they did not create what most military commanders said had to happen, and that was to keep a residual U.S. force in there to train and to keep training and equipping and planning with Iraqi forces. Plus, and this is crucial, to have leverage with the Iraqi politicians. Former Ambassador Ryan Crocker has said that these people almost never got along. There were always arguments, and this is a nascent attempt at coming out of a dictatorship. What they needed was a third party to play the honest broker and to mediate. The United States was that. But when it withdrew its forces, it then didn't have any leverage. And therefore, over the last several years, Maliki has been able to simply shunt out the Sunnis and create a Shia-dominated leadership. And I spoke to former Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi as Mosul was being taken, and he told me that why did the Iraqi division simply collapse and run, turn and flee in the face of ISIS? Because, and these are his words, they had nothing to fight for. Imagine what that means. They feel they had nothing to fight for. They were not enfranchised, these military forces. And that is a very big problem that has to be sorted out. But the immediate problem is to try to hold the line, not let ISIS advance any further, and then somehow try to create a coalition that can attempt to push them back. Many believe that is going to be incredibly difficult, and that what's going to happen is hardened de facto partition lines.
And this may be a turning point in history in the sense that because the U.S. didn't make a hard agreement when there were forces on the ground in Anbar and then withdrew because the Iranians said, no, you can't stay. Now, if there is an alliance with Iran, we're the small seat at the table. We're not the big seat at the table. Iran is calling the shots here, right?
You know, let's face it, Iran has the most influence with Nouri al-Maliki. That's absolutely for sure. We understand from reporting that Maliki asked the United States for airstrikes and all sorts of advanced weapons over the last several weeks and months when it was clear that ISIS was gaining a foothold. And that was basically denied. But, John, people have to understand that unless the swamp in Syria is drained, this is not going to have a chance in hell of succeeding in Iraq. Any attempt to push back what's happened in Iraq will simply keep getting bolstered from Syria. This is a very, very dangerous, world-shattering situation. I'm not going to say it's global World War III, but in that area, in the Iraq, Syria, and possibly, you know, shattering the stability of Lebanon and other surrounding countries, this could be a very, very dangerous thing. One official said to me, this reminds him of what happened in Afghanistan in 1994, when the Taliban swept up in a surprise move from Pakistan and simply kept pushing until they held the majority of the country and until finally they held the whole country. Then what happened there? It was the incubator for al-Qaeda. These people, ISIS, are even worse than al-Qaeda. They have splintered off from al-Qaeda because they don't think al-Qaeda is radical and brutal enough. This is a very dramatic situation, and a lot of it has been enabled by letting Syria fester like this over these last few years.
Christian Amanpour, chief international correspondent for CNN and host of Amanpour. Christian, thanks as always.
Thank you, John.
And now let's bring in Kenneth Pollack, former CIA intelligence analyst. He served on the National Security Council and is now at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thanks very much for having me.
One of the scenarios on the table here seems to me among the grimmest ironies in this whole affair right now, that the U.S. would ally with Iran to possibly push back the Sunni forces pushing south. What do you think of that?
Well, at some level, I think it's probably going to be necessary because at the end of the day, Iraq is in extremely dire straits. We need to get the situation stabilized, and that's going to require getting any help that we possibly can. And at the end of the day, we and the Iranians do have some similar interests in Iraq. We both want it stabilized. But we've got to remember that beyond that very narrow set of interests that we do share, we also have some very big differences about where we'd like to see Iraq go.
But yet this would be another step elevating Iran into a regional power, even beyond which they achieved after the end of combat hostilities. I don't know what that even means anymore in the Iraq invasion.
Right. Well, unfortunately, this is the reality that we face. Given the way that the United States has handled Iraq, we have effectively ceded the playing field to the Iranians. And we now have to recognize the reality that as we pulled back, as we disengaged, they moved in.
I was looking back at some of the history of Nouri al-Maliki's ascension as president, and it seems on some level he was handpicked, almost pulled out of a deck, almost at random by U.S. policymakers. Can you give us a sense of where Nouri al-Maliki came from? Certainly it was well understood that he was a Shiite, and it was well understood that he wasn't necessarily a unifier, but he really seems to have engineered this sectarian fracture.
Yeah, I think when this is all said and done, that history is going to be a fascinating one for a lot of people, because you're absolutely right. What happened was that in 2005, the militias were largely in charge in Baghdad, and the United States was trying desperately to find someone who wouldn't be too divisive. And we hit upon Nouri al-Maliki simply because he was an unknown quantity. He was kind of a nothing. He was a mid-level official in one of the smaller Shia parties. And the assumption was that this guy wasn't threatening to anyone, and that's why he got to be prime minister. And, we have to say that early on, Maliki didn't do badly. I mean, let's remember that in 2007, 2008, with a tremendous amount of American prodding, and that's being very kind, he did kind of rise above his kind of narrow Shia background, and he became something of a national unifying figure. After that, he then kind of devolved back to his origins. He's someone who's deeply suspicious of Sunni. He sees every Sunni as an old Ba'athist. And what we saw, especially after the American troops withdrew, was he acted in a kind of paranoid fashion to go after any of his rivals, many times in a very unconstitutional fashion. And that kind of split the Iraq that he had helped to start unify. But, what you find is that when you've got a security vacuum, when you've got a kind of a nasty sectarian dictator, which unfortunately is what Nouri al-Maliki has become, it becomes almost impossible to keep a country like this together.
Finally, Ken, you supported the Iraq invasion in 2003. Would you support it again today?
Yeah, well, first of all, John, what I'd say is I supported an invasion in 2003. I did not support the one that George Bush launched. And I warned at the time that the way that the Bush administration was conducting it was, and my exact words were, going to create as many problems as it solved. And I said it was going to push the country into chaos, warlordism, and civil war. And I specifically said we should not be doing it under those circumstances. Well, that's what we did.
Kenneth Pollack, former CIA intelligence analyst. He served on the National Security Council and is now at the Brookings Institution. Ken, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
There's a cold war today between the United States and Ghana. There's no geostrategic significance to this confrontation. It's all about soccer, football. The U.S. faces Ghana in their opening match at the World Cup in Brazil today, and Ghana has the U.S.'s number in the record books. Going back to 1983, Ghana has beaten the U.S. team 5-0, 1-0. It was 2-1 in 2006, and the heartbreaking 2-1 result that put Ghana into the quarterfinals and knocked the U.S. out of the tournament in 2010. Joining me now is Robert Asare Okoto, a New Yorker and lifelong soccer fan who proudly moved from Ghana to New York City 7 years ago. And if you think his change of country or passport has changed his football allegiance when the U.S. meets Ghana today, well, you would be wrong. Welcome, Robert.
First of all, I'll say thank you for having me.
Of course, of course.
Yeah, no.
Get the polite stuff out of the way. That's right.
Ghana is going to destroy U.S. today.
Really?
Yeah.
Because?
Because of our style of playing. When we're playing soccer or football that we know, it's 4-4-2. We're going to destroy U.S. U.S. has never scored Ghana. They never beat us.
All right. So basically, you're going to be reliving this moment at the end of today.
Asamoah Gyan on the far side. Chirundolo gets the ball. And look at the watch! And it's a glorious night for Ghana! Africa have a team in the quarterfinals of this World Cup! Asamoah Gyan is the hero of the hour! The Black Stars have done it! They've knocked out the United States of America!
Yep.
And Ghana break new ground on the world footballing stage!
It's going to happen again.
I wish everyone could see your face right now.
It's going to happen again. Yeah. It's going to happen again. The Ghana Black Star, they're going to do it again.
All right. Now, you came here 7 years ago, right?
Right.
Yeah. And your passport is?
Yeah, I'm married to an American. I'm a citizen now.
So doesn't that pull your heartstrings a little bit, maybe?
Not at all.
We hear these stories all the time about, oh, I wanted to come to America. I really wanted to come. It was my dream my whole life. I get here, and now you root for Ghana.
You see, this is where it gets confused with people. So I'm here, so now. No. I was born and raised in Ghana.
Right.
No matter what, I'll be a Ghanaian. It doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? No matter what, I'll be a Ghanaian. But at the same time, my kids are American. My wife is American. You know, my house, when we're watching this football, it's amazing.
Well, I knew I had no chance in hell of getting you to, root against Ghana. I knew that, but I gave it my best shot.
Oh. If U.S. is playing, I'm always going for U.S. But U.S. against Ghana, I'm going for Ghana.
So if the U.S. can get past Ghana, you're with us the rest of the way.
No, U.S. is not passing Ghana. That's the thing.
Oh, okay. All right. I tried. I tried one more time. Robert Asare Okoto, where are you going to be watching?
I haven't made a decision yet. Because sometimes when you go to the bars and you watch, there's too much noise. I want to hear what the commentators are saying about a game. You know, so sometimes too much noise. Sometimes, you know, watching at home, you can really, you know, hear and you can talk, you know. You know, so I haven't made a decision yet. This match is very, very important to me. So I have to, yeah.
All right. Well, good luck and may the best team win.
Thank you. Ghana, by the way, Ghana is going to give U.S. 3-0.
3-0?
3-0.
You heard it right there from
and
Robert Asare Okoto.
After the goal, just look at the dancing. It's called Azonto. The name of the dancing, when they score, it's called Azonto. Yes, just look at it.
Right,
3-0.
We're going to get you in here if there's no Azonto dance.
Oh, there will be Azonto dance. The difference is going to be Azonto dance.
Yet, but I am somewhat depressed. I own several pairs of shoes. Should I choose to get dressed?
When he writes songs, Loudon Wainwright III loves to look back at the high points and low points of his life. But when he sings and just shoots the breeze, he faces squarely forward with a sunny face that says, "Hey, what's next?" Hard to believe the writer of Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, that combines the prophetic truth of Plato with the universality of a Marx Brothers gag. Hard to believe he's in his 60s now. His famous Life magazine journalist father passed away in 1988, and in this period of his creative life, Loudon has created a new album and a one-man show called Surviving Twin that he says is an opportunity to collaborate posthumously with Loudon 1 and 2 and feel proud of and to just express his feelings about his very creative and musical family as well.
I'm very proud of that and jealous.
Really? Really?
I'm being a little flip, but it's the Oedipal thing, you know. You know, I don't want to be replaced. When I read articles about any of them and they say, when they refer to the person they're writing about as Wainwright, I think, wait a minute, I'm Wainwright.
Yeah.
Wainwright's fifth album is a beautiful piece of work. And, it's just that...
Wainwright is not a generic term. Be more specific here.
Exactly.
What made you decide to do this show?
Well, a lot of that is related to that, you know, because my dad was well-known growing up. So I know what it was like to have a famous father. And it was thrilling and irritating. And we had a kind of competitive relationship, I'd say. Anyway, he died in 1988, and I found myself going back and rereading all his work.
Wow.
And a lot of it I loved, particularly his personal stuff. And then I started, and on that record, Older Than My Old Man Now, I actually did two recitations of his work and connected them with a couple of my songs.
What's that song?
Well, there's a recitation, he does this thing called, about his father, Loudon the First, which goes, "If I remain still, if I'm alone and silent long enough to hear the sound of my own blood or breathing or digestion above the rustling of leaves and the whir of the refrigerator, my father is likely to turn up. He just arrives unbidden in the long-running film of my thoughts, like Hitchcock in his pictures. And he looks for all these 40-plus years of disembodiment, much like himself, big and sandy-haired with freckles on the backs of his hands, perhaps a bit more diffident in the way he holds himself than I remember. He doesn't stay long. And as far as I can tell, his visits have no message. Yet even though years of therapy have led me to make the dark, whistling claim that he's finally dead and gone, my father, who died when I was 17, continues to be my principal ghost, a lifelong eminence grise, and only my own end will finish it."
Holy moly. Those are your dad's words about your grandpa.
Yeah, and then I follow with a song.
Older than my old man now. He died at 63, that's way too young. Now you gotta feed me, now you gotta need me, and I feel like a faithless son.
That's intimidating, that language, that just flowing language like that. Wow. It just sounds like it came to him in one single thought.
Well, I think he was a good writer. He was a great writer, I think. Yeah. And that's part of the fun of this, is despite the competitive thing, now more than 25 years after he's passed away, I'm celebrating his work and connecting it with mine.
Was there ever a moment when you went back and looked at that material and wished that that voice had addressed just you, had been talking to just you, recalling maybe some of those combative conversations? Because dads always talk to their kids in a much different voice than the rest of the world hears them.
Yes. I mean, I remember going to his memorial service and meeting all these people that knew him that I didn't know, people in his therapy group and people that were younger than me at the time. And they were talking about what a great, warm, wonderful, open, accessible guy. Your dad was the most, you know, and I believe them. I think he was. But again, when you're in a situation with your own kids, it's you're being the dad and you're being then. And they're the, gosh, they, what a pain in the ass you kids are, and, you know.
You know, it's really disorienting for kids to realize that their parents had a life, first of all, before them and have a whole life without them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have a song which is actually on my new record that I wrote for Rufus's 40th birthday, which was last July.
Right.
And the name of the song is "I Knew Your Mother."
I knew your mother, let me be clear. We were lovers before you got here. So don't forget that I knew her when love was the means and you were the end.
And there's a little thing about the biblical aspect of that.
Right, right.
But also, that's exactly what the song is about. It's about, you know, I knew her before you were here.
Right.
We were in love with each other. We had sex together. And then you came along. And the payoff is love was the means and you were the end.
You wrote in this album about depression, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you write about depression?
It's what's going on. So I'm writing about it. I have it sometimes. I have some friends that have had it. I mean, worse than me.
Blind Lemon sings the blues. The Jew does his wailing session. So tell me what you plan to do about all of that depression. Will you suck it up or ride it out? Or reread some old fan letter? Head to the nearest bar room to stay drunk till it gets better.
You know, depression is so mystifying because in many ways the power of depression comes from how at odds it is with the objective reality of your life. I mean, you look at your life, it's like, it must be just like laughs all the time, loud and
waving,
dead
great.
Skunk, middle of the road, Rufus Wainwright. You're depressed. What a waste of depression.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
you to be depressed.
Yeah. Well, then you have to get depressed about being depressed. It's just, you know, or you hate, you know, you loathe yourself. Or why should I be wallowing in my... But I go back to the theory that what's happening to me is happening to you, the big, you know, the public. So the idea is to affect people, you know, to make some kind of a connection.
Loudon Wainwright III is a singer-songwriter. His latest album, Haven't Got the Blues Yet, is set to be released in September. To get information on how to see his one-man show called Surviving Twin, visit us at thetakeaway.org.
I know you're in a hurry. You're probably late for work.
We'll end this hour where we began, thinking about Iraq. Two voices told us emphatically this hour that unless something decisive happens on the battlefield, Iraq and possibly Syria will cease to exist. In their place, there will be possibly three nations: Kurdistan, a nation yearned for by Kurds since Ottoman times, a Sunni caliphate controlled by the Iraqi militants who call themselves ISIS, a fanciful idea that goes back to the beginnings of Islam itself more than 1,000 years ago, and a united nation for all Shiite Muslims, something first imagined in 1501 when Iran came into being. To discuss the possibility of these scenarios and also the situation on the ground, Faisal Istrabadi joins us, director of the Center for the Study of the Middle East at Indiana University, former Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations. Ambassador, welcome.
My pleasure.
Is this partition? I've been asking this question since last week, but I'll ask you as well.
It could be. The Iraqis have to decide collectively, not just the political class, but the people of Iraq have to decide whether they want to live in the same country or not. If they do, then there are certain ramifications to answering that question in that way. If they don't, I do not believe that Iraq will break cleanly into three separate countries. I think that although the Kurds in the north are more viable than the rest of the country if Iraq falls apart, for the rest of the country, Somalia, I think, is a much more likely scenario than a clean break into three states.
Well, before we take a look at the delightful scenario of Somalia that you raised there, the Kurds seem to have already made their decision, and they decided some years ago that they'll wait this out. But they've always been pretty open in their belief that they'd rather go it alone.
I have no doubt that if you had a referendum, a free and fair referendum in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, that the overwhelming majority of the Kurds would vote for independence. I think, however, the leadership has calculated that having self-rule, having autonomy within an internationally recognized border is an advantage to them. Remember, it's a landlocked country. It would be a very small country tucked in between much, much more powerful neighbors. So there are real reasons that it has been beneficial to them to stay within a united Iraq. Whether that calculation has changed in the last week, you know, we're going to see reasonably soon.
And Turkey holds those cards. If a Kurdish flag flies over Erbil and Kirkuk, it's conceivable that the Turks will have something to say about that.
Well, not just Turkey. I mean, I must say that right now the relationship between Iraqi Kurdistan and the current government of Turkey is very good. In fact, Erbil has a much better relationship with Ankara than Baghdad does. But it isn't just Turkey. It's Turkey, it's Iran. If the rest of Iraq, let's assume Kurdistan gains independence and somehow the rest of Iraq is able to pull back from the brink and hold itself together, and even if Syria ever manages to reconstitute itself, the long-term perspectives are that a landlocked, small Kurdistan could conceivably face tense relations with all of its neighbors.
Let's talk about the Shiites for a moment. Is it possible that the Arab Persian split between Iranian Shiites and Arab Shiites in Iraq would prevent a real sort of unification there. Even Iran taking the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala as a kind of a protectorate?
Well, that the Iranians have influence with particularly the Shia political class is beyond question. But remember, one of the myths about Iraq that you hear from time to time is that the Iraqi Shia are, you know, Iranian or in origins or in tendencies, and it's simply not true. Something like 85% or 90% of Iraq's Shia are Arab, not Persian. And there have always been tensions between the two. And I'll simply say that the Iraqi Shia, had they felt any loyalty towards Iran, could have brought about the end of the state of Iraq in as far long ago as 1980, during the eight-year war between Iran and Iraq, when Iraq's Shia bled and died for Iraq.
Would Iran try to grab the Shatt al-Arab waterway, the Basra port, and basically control the entire oil spigot there at the at the north end of the Gulf?
Well, I mean, it's always possible, and there are situations you can imagine when it might do that. If my scenario comes to pass of a of genuine chaos on the Iranian borders, they might be tempted. But Iran right now is also trying to work out its relations with the West, including the United States. In the short run, I don't think it wants to jeopardize those kinds of economic and commercial ties in exchange for buying a whole lot of trouble for itself.
Although the Somalia scenario that you describe, I mean, this isn't the Horn of Africa, off in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, believe me, I have a heart that bleeds for the people of Somalia. I've been to Somalia. But this would be a chaotic, warlord-driven land in the middle of the richest oil-producing region in the world. I mean, it would almost be like setting a Somalia down in the middle of Europe. It would be Switzerland as Somalia.
I think so. I think it would be absolute chaos and would constitute a genuine threat to, it would be chaos for the Middle East, but it would also be a genuine threat to U.S. and Western interests and vital interests, as you say, oil and natural gas and so on. You know, in Somalia, the pirates go out on the seas to kidnap people and hold them for ransom to make money. In Iraq, a state like ISIS, as you were describing, would control natural resources such as oil and gas. It's a nightmare scenario. It could fund itself. I mean, just imagine Iraq dropping down to Somalia north of Saudi Arabia and the other countries bordering it are Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. And remember, Turkey is a NATO ally. It's just a nightmare scenario not to be contemplated.
Ambassador, just looking back at all of this, remembering the casualties during the war, the scenarios that were spun out as the U.S. made its decision to go in, this just seems like an utterly heartbreaking waste of so much.
Yeah, well, let me count the ways. You know, it's been I have to say, as I look back on the last 11 years, I told a colleague the other day that it seems none of my aspirations for Iraq have come to pass. My worst fears have all come true.
Faisal Esterbadi, it's great talking to you. Perhaps on another occasion we'll have a slightly more upbeat conversation. Inshallah.
Inshallah, from your lips to God's ear, as they say in New York.
Faisal Esterbadi is director of the Center for the Study of the Middle East at Indiana University, former Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations. Final thought. Secretary of State Colin Powell once said of U.S. intervention in Iraq, if you break it, you buy it. We've got a very broken-looking Iraq, as we've been discussing. Should the U.S. take responsibility for buying it now? How much have we already paid to get to this point? Should we pay any more? We'd love to hear your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send a tweet at The Takeaway. And remember, the United States takes on Ghana this evening. We'll see if America can finally defeat the Black Stars for the first time in 30 years. Send us pictures of how you root for your favorite team in the World Cup by using the hashtag MySoccerSwag on Twitter and Instagram. That's MySoccerSwag, all one word. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.